So that instead of just going to his own community, if he had really met two major communities and made himself, learned to make himself agreeable to them, I think that would remarkably soon have assisted him very greatly. Because, you know, I haven't any doubt that the more serious-minded people who joined the Royal Asiatic Society and such like could have found answers to some of the problems which I didn't find an easy answer to. Mm-hmm. If in point of fact he had not merely found his life bounded by European clubs. Mm-hmm.
This is a criticism that has been made by other civil servants, though only a few. You would say then that the Ceylon civil service was far too aloof from the people.
Well, yes, well, if you like. I'm not sure. I wouldn't also say the people far too aloof from it. Anyhow, there was a distinct cleavage. And you know, this is very interesting, because if you go back to the early days of Ceylon, there was no cleavage at all between the Europeans who then developed and owned estates or whatever it may be. They moved and mingled freely with communities of the country. Mm-hmm. But that became completely lost after the introduction of the Limited Liability Company and the establishment of civil service separate from and governing the country.
Mm-hmm. W.T. Stace has gone even further. He has written some memoirs in typescript, and in a general review of British rule in Ceylon, he says that one of his criticisms is that the British community, that's not the unofficials included, were guilty of arrogance.
I have no doubt they were.
And you feel that there were many occasions when there were slights.
Well, that sort of thing, I mean, the arrogance was a thing that was gradually built up, but as I say, it did not start with the early encounter or anything to do. I haven't any doubt the very early community was going on to be military. Mm. And I'm perfectly certain that what started in that way and was also assisted by the development of the country in private hands. I mean private hands. I mean,
yes.
There was no limited liability. They took a personal risk and they mingled freely with the people with whom they needed to mingle, and there was no smart division by communities. Now those qualities were largely lost. It was a great pity they were lost.
On the other hand, did you feel that sometimes when the Ceylonese themselves, especially the educated Ceylonese, were ultra-sensitive on racial questions, colour bar questions?
I think they were highly sensitive, but then I don't see why I shouldn't have been. Mm-hmm. After all, this sensitiveness really became a form of self-expression, self-assertion. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but it was entirely
unjustified.
No, I don't know who it was.
I don't think so either. It's a natural reaction.
Absolutely. I mean, if you find somebody who apparently is asserting himself again you the whole time, it's not surprising if you assert yourself again him.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree with the view that the civil service could have done with more freemen?
More freemen. Well, yes, in his mind, but not in his method. I think his method was frightful. He recorded nothing, he gave no reasons for anything. I've seen a number of his minutes, you know, they were all nothing but obiter dicta. Well, the dicta on the whole, since he happened to favour one view of the Chena question, his views regained in popularity. Mm-hmm. But I do think, and he did have the guts to dispute with the government about certain things, and his attitude about the Chena question was really good. Mm-hmm. But his attitude about everything else wasn't good. Mm-hmm. I think he was a humane man. I think he was a really humane man, a really understanding man. But he, he really lacked method of pulling there.
No, I was not referring to his method as much as to his spirit and sympathy with the people.
Oh, no, I think it was good. Mm-hmm. That was first rate.
As a cadet, working in the office, did you feel that you were working blind and you just didn't know what you were doing?
So I didn't know what I was doing. I was said that my years as a cadet, really just left me understanding and learning what the government system of accountancy was.
Mm-hmm.
So in point of fact, I took no greater part in the management of Ceylon and really seeing that its various funds were properly brought to account and were themselves capably awarded. And I felt that was absolutely inadequate, since it was unexplained. But against that is extraordinarily useful, extraordinarily good, to find yourself pinned down to understanding how various contributions are brought to account. I do think that was good. What was damn bad was giving nothing any further intention than merely out of making a certain number of entries and a certain number of books.
Did you find that your superiors and the senior officers tended to treat you with, a sort of amused tolerance and little respect?
Who?
Whether the senior officers treated the cadets as, very, very young fry, inexperienced fry?
Well, no, I shouldn't think they do that, because after all, I went out after the First War. I had 4 years in the army, and I think he'd have been a very bold man who really treated me as a very small fry. I'm prepared to agree, but it was small fry. But I don't think many people, their attitude towards people who returned to war wasn't quite that. I think they were very anxious to cut them down to size, but not quite without respect.
Mm-hmm. Regarding one of Stacer's other criticisms, he says the chief his chief criticisms of British rule in Ceylon was that there was too much routine, and he even uses the word blind routine.
Well, I mean, I don't know, I dare say it is so. I mean, but routine is one of those words that's become dirty, but you know, if you routinate stuff, which after all has to be done fairly quickly, to get a routine attached to it is fairly useful.
Mm-hmm.
And so when somebody says there's too much routine, I wonder how much routine there is in local government in this country. Certainly not, I suspect. I suspect it's one of the vices by which you're unable to get through your work. Excuse me, I won't be able to. Well, I think, on the whole, it's really quite stupid to do the sort of position which the Ceylon Civil Service held, and I think was meant to hold. It should have been not concerned beyond the point of understanding a system to follow up books of account and such like. It really should have been a body of people who really were concerned, as we were concerned in the corporate department, to teach something which was of much more permanent value. And I think that it's quite easy to think that if you routinate the higher spheres of office excessively, it's a very grave defect in your use of manpower.
Well, I think this is what Stace was getting at, and certainly this is one of Mr. Newton's points, that by and large, British rule lacked drive and purpose in the sense of ultimate aims.
Well, that I think is quite true, because I remember so frightfully well, I was particularly prominent in a body of opinion, which at the time of the Don Moore Commission,
mm-hmm.
really said, okay, we want some instruction, we want to know whether, in point of fact, we are to hand over at speed, or whether we're to hand over at slow.
Mm-hmm.
I never got an answer to that, either from the Civil Service Commission, or from the Governor, or from the Secretary of State. And I still think it was a really relevant question, which was addressed, actually, to the purpose of our being in Ceylon.
You put that question to the Don Moore Commission, did you?
God, I can't remember, but I put it to 1,001 people. either there or in the civil service afterwards.
Did you feel that in British times, that's in the 1920s, that they didn't know where they were quite going, and that they were just making efficiency an end in itself?
Well, I should think so, but in point of fact, I don't really quite feel like that, because I myself, in due course, I retired because I believed that, like a head of the cooperative department, there should be a man of the island. And I thought the right thing to do was to hand over to a man of Ceylon.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when I really felt my own service come to an end.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that brings us to the question of Ceylonization. But before that, again raising one of Mr. Newnham's points, did you feel that at the top and in the secretariat there was a tendency or even a policy of quiet and non-movery, preserving the status quo?
I know, but I'm just wondering where there was. I think he should work that one out. I dare say there was. I mean, I dare say there was, because there was quite enough. I mean, you say create a non-movery, but really, what was quiet? There was a whole world of change going on anyhow, and that is really only another form of asking the same question that I am asking. Are we to hand over quickly or slowly?
Mm-hmm.
I felt that question needed answering, and it was not answered, either in the Colonial Secretary's office or anywhere else, nor by the local governor.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I suppose, since I did ask that and I never felt it was answered, I feel that I'm bound to agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
But I shouldn't say not a question of disturbing what was peaceful. It was really a question of not adding one more change to a whole body of change which was moving, but we didn't know in what direction or with what purpose. And what's more, anyone who could say was not willing to say. But I don't think that lay with the governor. I don't think it was the governor to decide when he was to hand over in Ceylon. When the governor was all-powerful in Ceylon, it may have been up to him. But when ultimate authority was buzzed back to the Secretary of State, it was not for him to say, but it was for him to get a direction.
Mm-hmm.
He should have raised a question. And of course, whether or not he would have had it answered in Downing Street is now a question.
Yes.
But he should have raised the question. The question was due to be raised, it should have been raised.
At a slightly lower level, did you feel that the Secretariat was rather obstructionist when it came to trying out new ideas, new improvements?
I only experienced the Secretariat close quarters in William Manning's day.
Mm-hmm.
William Manning was a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
He tended to place great reliance on his civil service. He himself was not an obstructionist.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very curious thing. I mean, I should think politically, he was always against Gunasinghe. He couldn't bear.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't bear this sort of disturbance.
Yes.
But I don't think he was at all opposed to the sort of development which wasn't merely a political disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he had a soldier's ability to face difficult, but he only had a very limited soldier's limited personal ability. I'm talking about that. But I think that his frame of mind was conventional but tolerably broad.
Mm-hmm.
And I go to distrust people who had been a remarkable scholarly attainment at university and came out of what I tend to believe. They were far more ossified in their views than those who would come up and look to other people to guide them
mm-hmm.
into ways of thinking, because they didn't think they had already thought everything out for themselves. But that's entirely a personal view. I mean, I actually felt that William Manning, who was a soldier, not a very enlightened one, was on the whole a very, very shrewd, practical, liberal-minded man.
Mm-hmm. Would Clementi and Stubbs be examples of your other types?
Clementi, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Quite definitely. Stubbs, I hardly knew Stubbs. I knew his widow very well indeed. She's a charming woman.
Mm-hmm.
But I commend him quite definitely. But he was a typical sort of man who, on the whole, thought he knew everything.
Impractical? Who would say he was?
Well, I wouldn't. I dare say. I hadn't any great bit of. I hadn't any great admiration for him.
What about Fletcher and Tyrrell and Wedderburn?
Well, I wouldn't regard Wedderburn as merely a civil servant. Fletcher and Tyrrell, I think, were, I think, small-minded people.
Mm-hmm.
But don't quote me as saying this.
Mm-hmm. What was Manning's attitude to Guru Singh?
Well, I can only remember one particular thing. He was on leave when Guru Singh, famous trike.
Yes.
And he came back and was horrified to discover that Clemente had met Guru Singh.
Mm-hmm.
And he always felt that really Guru Singh was made a big man from that moment. And that was an absolute stock example of Manning's very, very great penetration. He made them known much about political issues, but he didn't know how to make or not to make a man.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt that Clemente had really blown Gunnarsson up to twice life size.
Mm-hmm. But I noticed the tendency to look down on agitators of this sort. Would you say that they were against trade union activity because it was led by men like Guna Singh, or because they were against trade union activity per se?
I haven't any idea.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, in this particular case, William Manning believed that the leader of a trade union dispute,
mm-hmm,
could be made a big man or he could be kept in size. And he thought when the colonial secretary went down to meet him, he was really making him a big man, and that he was not in favour of.
Mm-hmm. But there are notions of prestige here.
Maybe, I don't know at all. But I mean, prestige was what Clemente gave to Gunnarsson. And whether Gunnarsson exercised that wisely or not, leave somebody else to say.
Mm-hmm. Returning to the question of civilization. I know that the non-European civil servants had a feeling that they were shunted into the judicial line and excluded from the G.A.ships in particular. Was there a definite tendency at the start, in the 1920s, to exclude?
Well, I don't know. I should think it was. Because in the 1920s, there were some very senior Europeans. I mean, and so without knowing anything about it at all, I should say that Europeans automatically, and probably largely by seniority. But at a much later date, since my own two deputies, and not G.A.'s jobs, my own two deputies and subsequent commissioners were Singhalese, I don't feel that really lasted.
No, I know it didn't last till the 1930s.
No, I don't think it did.
But I was wondering whether there was a sort of definite tendency to keep them in the judicial line, even in the 1920s. The first Serenese AGA was in 1923, but he had been 14 years in the service before he was made an AGA, which is quite a long time.
Yes, I should think so, but I don't. Who was he in service?
C.L. Wickramasinghe.
Who?
C.L. Wickramasinghe.
Oh, really? Was he indeed? Mm. No, he was a very efficient man now. What did he end up as?
Commissioner of Lands. Well, he was one of the, I think, Land Commissioner, one of the chief.
Yes, right? Yes. Now, the GAs whom I knew in the 1920s were all Europeans, but so far as I can recollect, they were all Europeans who, in point of fact, were GAs by a sort of seniority. I'd have to look up facts. I don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought they were all GAs by seniority. People like, you know, Dyson was them.
Yes, I know. But if there were men like Paul Pierce and even my father who felt that they were kept in the judicial line.
Yeah, well, I mean, then I should say that's so. He probably is personally conscious of it, and I should just accept his word for it.
Mm-hmm. I've seen a memo by Bowes, who's a bit of a diehard, really, on this Bowes, Freddie Bowes.
Oh, yeah, yes.
On against the higher employment of Sirenes. Arguing for it. One of his arguments, the principal one, I should say, was that Sirenes, the people of Ceylon, would never trust the impartiality of a Sirenes civil servant.
Well, that's obviously what would always be said. How you would say it with any seriousness, unless you've tried it and found it to be true, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And also he said, Sirenes lacked cool-headedness in a crisis, and the stability of government would be undermined.
I think Paul Pierce is the name that you've given. I'd entirely forgotten him, but he was a very senior man.
Mm-hmm.
And so far as I know, he was always a district judge, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I don't think he was a very good judge, but... one can argue, if they can't be given responsibility as GAs, how can you make them judges? It's true there is appeal, but... it calls for quite a lot of discretion, too.
Yes.
Getting on to another subject, did you suffer at all from political interference in the
1920s? I wouldn't say that I did. I must have a moment to think about that. I know that much later, juniors of mine said that they did. Mm-hmm. I know that because they told me so here. But I can't remember any sort of political interference at my level. You see, I was doing a special job. I don't think it would have particularly interested anybody. The only person who was inclined to interfere was Senanaka, who on the whole interfered, so far as he did interfere, from very good motives. So I don't think that I personally experienced the sort of political interference that you have in mind. But I don't really feel very, not very competent to answer it.
What about when you were AGA Kegal?
No, I had no political interference at all.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the only political interference I never remember, was when I was District Judge Bedua,
mm-hmm.
when I had an extraordinarily impertinent letter from Fletcher, for which he apologised later on. I may say, he having written an extremely impertinent letter, quite beyond his legal competence, to me, he withdrew it and apologized.
This has been
it was definitely not political interference of anyone in the island. It was a political interference from the colonial secretary, actually.
This has been a criticism of Fletcher that he listened to advice from side channels and took a decision about the head of an AGA and GA without consulting them.
Well, I didn't know, but I'm not at all surprised. It's a particularly vicious form. The administration by a rather inferior officer.
Mm-hmm. Was the secretariat a bottleneck in the 1920s?
I should think so, but I don't know. In the 1920s, no, Mabin and Young and Mabin, I think, were in the 20s, and I should think they all worked so jolly hard that they rather killed themselves and held everything up.
I know that. I mean, I'm not questioning the ability of the officers,
but
I was wondering whether there was too much going through this channel.
I should say so. I should say, I mean, on a matter of general principle, I should say that a Queen government office sitting there is bound, in point of fact, to get it inundated.
Coming to the Donoghue Constitution, what was your reaction to their proposals?
I think, I'm not sure about this, but I think the Donoghue Commission chiefly raised the position and the service of the men like myself. In other words, I should say it that I failed entirely to appreciate what it was after. I'm quite sure about this. I think but after Donald Moore Christian, we had really much more self-government for Ceylon, haven't we?
Yes, seven ministers. Senanayake and Crowdy. Senanayake was in charge of the lands and corporation and so on.
Yes, that was it, wasn't it? And it was really the first time we had an elected council.
That's right, universal franchise.
Yes. Well, in that case, and with my own personal experience, with outside myself, is entirely limited to one night when I was staying in a rest house on cooperative duty, and somebody, some new elected member, drove up in the rest house compound, chucked crackers round, and made a most frightful drunken noise. And I thought, my God, this is awful.
No, but I was wondering whether the grant of universal franchise, for instance, raised doubts and fears.
Well, it raised considerable, me myself, yes, because I disagreed entirely with Jimson's view that education had nothing whatever to do with voting rights. Mm-hmm. And I still disagree with it. I disagree with everywhere where alleged democratic principles are asserted. It seems to me that to assert that merely to exist as a citizen is enough to give you a right to elect your controlling body is a hell which is fraught with danger. In fact, I think you can see how dangerous it is when you look at some of the African states.
Yes, but the idea behind the Donald Moore Commission's grant of universal franchise was that if they did not do so, they would in effect be setting up a middle-class oligarchy.
What was it? But I don't know. I mean, more or less it was. I think it was Jimson who wrote a authorized white paper on the right to vote, or something of that sort. I think it was.
Mm-hmm. This was before.
And in point of fact, he absolutely eliminated any sort of educational claim to consideration in electoral rights. He may have pinned them on to existence, to be alive. We hadn't got to show any quality of, so far as I remember, any quality of responsibility at all. I always felt, I'm completely on my own here, I felt then and I feel now, that in point of fact, it's a very deadly policy. It's a policy which is bound to lead to a degeneration.
You see, one of the arguments was that there had hardly been any social legislation before, and that the very fact that the middle class didn't want universal franchise was a danger, and that once there was this franchise, government would be more responsive to social demands.
Well, I mean, that presumably is an argument based entirely on some circumstances prevailing in Ceylon, but I don't know. But I still think that merely to say, well, if you can breathe quickly enough, you shall gain sooner or later supreme power, is a hellish proposition, and one which fully justifies Aristotle's contempt for a democratic government.
Mm-hmm. What about this executive committee system?
Well, the executive committee.
Under the Donald Moore, you had these ministries and these people in the State Council, in the Executive Committee, about 8 in each committee, and they had a hand in administration.
Yes, well, I'm afraid I don't really know anything about it, because I never experienced it at all. I never experienced any of their decisions or any activities there at all, so far as I'm aware.
Did you feel that this change from before 1931 and after 1931 brought a greater drive and a sense of where you were going, which you hadn't had before?
Well, I don't think it did to me, because I was chiefly concerned with a specialist department.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think any of them knew enough about it. I mean, to exercise the influence they might have. They could be far more influential, I have no doubt, in other matters and other districts. But I was comparatively insulated, or at least I suspect so. I certainly wasn't aware of any increased drive, but I don't feel that negative answer is of any value at all, because it's related entirely to a specialist employment of my own.
How would you assess DSN NACA as a minister?
Well, I don't believe I'm capable of assessing ministers, but you know, I think what I really feel is he had some of the gutty qualities of Churchill.
Mm-hmm.
He really, I mean, whether that, if you get an American book of psychology, you'll find all the list of virtues attached to everybody who's going to hold a responsible post, and of course it's all absolute bunkum. Churchill was a man of great quality, of great leadership, and I think Senanaka had guts and he had quality.
Common sense?
Well, he was always known as a buffer, you know, so you wouldn't say that common sense was actually his outstanding quality. But purpose and drive certainly were, and there's nothing wrong with his main programs, irrigation and such like. There was no quality of bad sense in them. Whether they were related to available finances of those days, I wouldn't know. I just wouldn't know. But I do feel that in point of fact, he was putting up a very, very good performance in a place where there was ample opportunity for someone else to try and unsettle him.
What sort of men was Standee and Thompson?
Who?
Sir Herbert Standee and Sir Graham Thompson. As far as I can gather, Standee was rather colourless.
I would say so. I would say he was. I mean, I can get really just about described. But I think that Thompson was a very able man. When he was governor, he was a very elderly man.
Mm.
I can get it it tends to make him far less incisive than he might have been. Besides, the times didn't really allow a governor great scope, I don't think. No, not then.
Of course, coming to this Donoghue constitution, one thing that did arise in these early years, and which was to be expected to an extent, was the friction between these three officers of state and the ministers and the state council.
Yes.
And in a sense, while some of it was inevitable, I wondered whether it could partially be attributed to the personalities of these officers of state, that's Tyrrell and Woods especially.
Well, maybe, but you know, I will agree with you. If you put three people of any quality where they will be in contact and in conflict, you're pretty certain to find a conflict prevailing, unless in fact there are some other qualities which make two or more of them combine in friendship.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was wondering whether Woods and Tyrrell, for instance, whether they were the rather standoffish kind.
Well, I think Tyrrell's a very awkward man.
Mm-hmm.
I think he went out to so long at a time when other qualities than those which were esteemed later on were highly esteemed, and I think he was a pretty awkward man.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's a damned awkward man to deal with. I mean, I'm quite fond of him in a kind of way, but I think he's a very awkward man. I should hate to be one of a team.
With him?
I should, yes, because I don't believe he has any great gift of combining.
Mm-hmm. And certainly Stubbs, I know, as a governor, he was a rather cold man.
I think so, yes. Yes, I do think so.
What about Wedderburn? I know he was a very courteous sort, but...
I should call him rather courteous, but I don't pretend to know. I should call him rather courteous. I think accurate and colourless, really.
Mm-hmm. Have you any inkling whether the ministers themselves were rather unreasonable and wanted too much?
No, I have no idea. Mm-hmm. I have no idea at all.
Mm-hmm.
I should be jolly surprised if he isn't. I'm sure it must be a quality of any new man to expect to get a larger cut than other people think is coming in way.
Yes, to go back in time, I mean, to the time when you were in the secretariat and then later private secretary, have you any idea whether this constitution which was proposed by Manning at that time was largely his work or a composite effort?
Well, I don't actually know historically which it was, but if Manning did take a great personal concern in whatever he put his name to.
Oh, I see.
Now, I would say that, I mean, I would say...
Hello, Pa. Hello. Your friend, Mr. King's here.
Oh, fine.
Everything was written to him with very great care, so while I don't suggest for a moment he initiated anything, I'm perfectly certain he passed nothing just like that.
Yes, that was sometimes a failing of some of the colonial secretaries. They hardly read anything.
Yes, I should say so. I should say so.
Can you recall the strike at all, the one that Guna Singh read?
Well, I can, but very faintly. But what?
It was, there were several strikes he read. I think this was a railway workman, that's right.
The only one I know anything about was Harbour. Harbour strike.
Yeah, the harbour also came out. Well, what happened in the harbour strike?
Well, they simply struck, and it was there that Clemente met and negotiated with Guna Singh.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was more or less settled, as I think it was.
Would it be correct to say that the secretary looked on him as an opportunist and a troublemaker?
Guna Singh? Well, I think they suddenly looked upon him. No, I don't know at all, but I would say they looked upon Guna Singh as a man who was building himself up and was really taking every opportunity of building himself up.
Well, this may have been so. I'm wondering whether they have been illiberal in the sense that Guna Singh may have been representing genuine grievances on the part of the workers at the same time.
Well, I couldn't say. Mm-hmm. I couldn't say. I wasn't in the secretariat.
Because, strange to say, in 1929, someone in the secretariat wrote a minute saying, I don't think Mr. Guna Singh is as black as he is painted out to be.
Oh, really? Yes.
But this shows a change of opinion, at least on his part.
Oh, really?
And certainly I know Guna Singh, while having an eye to the main charts, also was passionately for the worker,
yes.
And he didn't hit it off with other politicians who he felt were too divorced from the
reality. Yes. That's all beyond my scope. I mean, I can well imagine that it could be true, but I wasn't concerned. I wasn't in the Port Commission. I really knew nothing about. I knew nothing at first hand about port issues.
What were your impressions of the Land Settlement Department?
I can only say I was talking again. I don't really know. I believe that they worked some considerable accuracy, but I don't really know. I think that it was the habit, it was the fashion to say that they took
land and gave to the planters. That's the political criticism.
I was going to say that, in point of fact, they took a rather conservative, a far too conservative attitude towards the general China question. In other words, they wanted to reach a settlement. They took great pains about hearing and settling claims, but they were not inclined, I believe, to give great weight to nebulous claims which might have derived from nothing more than a use of land without any claim to ownership.
You feel they were too strict here?
Well, I don't know at all. No, I've always admired them, but I always thought that it was a very reasonable thing for a government to take, that if you're going to secure a title, you've just got to stick to certain general principles of ownership. And I always imagined that if the Chena question was to be solved, it wasn't to be solved by arbitrary decisions, but it really required registration. Mm-hmm. Recognizing something and giving a colour for it. But otherwise, you would find that nothing except repeated chain ring would give you any sort of title. You'd get a claim by constant use of a certain piece of land, but apart from that, you would have no recognition at all. Mm-hmm. You would have chained it and you would have absolutely no claim to show for it.
You see, Leonard Woolf's point and Freeman's is that in the dry zone, as distinct from the wet zone, these restrictions on chain were unrealistic in the sense that most of the land was useless land, old jungle, scrub, and it was a matter of life and death sometimes, and that they should allow them greater liberty in chain.
Well, I would accept the view of a man like Freeman about that, as I think he fully realized the need for some liberality. But don't press me about it, because when you find population pressing on the land, mm-hmm. it doesn't seem to be an answer really to distribute it prematurely. But I just feel that the whole chain of questioning really involved something far more elaborate than we ever contemplated. Mm-hmm. I think it was not really to be resolved by questions of settled title. I think the establishment of claims, chain-ring rights, mm-hmm. would have been possible. But I don't think there was any legislation which permitted recognition of chain of claims, which might have been extremely varied, because on the very ground the Wolf suggesting, mm-hmm. and in point of fact, there could well have been a historical, a traditional right of chain-ring. Now, I don't know that a right of chaining was ever recognized.
Of course, there was this political criticism of the Land Settlement Department in the 20s, and there is some suspicion that some of the politicians, not all of them, you know, not DS for example, that some of the politicians were themselves land speculators and land buyers who were been balked by this Land Settlement Department.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. No, that's news to me. No, mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
No, you didn't?
No, I didn't at all.
Mm-hmm. Didn't you ever come across some proctors and Sirenese who could be classed as land brokers, who bought up dubious claims and sold them again?
I've certainly heard of it, yes.
Oh, whereabouts?
Well, I think that these matters came my way both in Kende and in Colombo.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever come across conflicts between Sinhalese villagers and planters, you know, for land?
No, I never did. I don't know, it didn't exist, but I never came across it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.